Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
It has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big stop! Oh, brother!
Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yes, we're meeting a common, I don't know yeah, how to say it, a man we've met with frequently in this series, but he's back again.
Yes, Will Chamberlain.
Yeah.
He is back.
We
can't. Well, this will be our last time dealing with Wilton in an extensive level on this WrestleMania episode. It is the Celtics playoff battles against Wilt Chamberlain and the Philadelphia 76ers. Of course, they had already undergone many battles against Wilt when he was with the Philadelphia and San Francisco Warriors, now the second incarnation. And there would, of course, be more to come. Five, in fact, with the Sixers. The first four with Wilt, the final one without Wilt. We'll get into the circumstances of that. So starting with 1965, the Celtics won this series 4-3. Syracuse, as we mentioned in previous shows, the Nationals had moved to Philly for the 63-64 season. And the Nationals had been a pretty big rival with the Philadelphia Warriors, who had previously moved to San Francisco. So now it is a former rival moving to Philadelphia. And fans were, understandably initially resistant to the team. Largely, it was players they had, been booing just a couple years earlier. And I can't really think of, a precedent where a team, that had been a pretty hated rival suddenly moves to the town and keeps most of the players. Like, can you think of a situation that?
Off the top of my head, no. I mean, yeah, it's try to think, because baseball would have been the only one that I would think of to, my head immediately went to, oh, there's got to be a baseball situation to this or a baseball equivalent.
Yeah.
And there's,
I feel like all the teams that move generally move to cities that were, that did not have baseball before.
Well,
so.
I do get that from, I grew up obviously a White Sox fan or whatever. And I've always considered my National League team to be like the Milwaukee Brewers, because they're, in my lifetime or the most of my baseball watching lifetime, they have been in the National League. But my dad hates the Brewers. And he's like, well, yeah, they were our hated rivals for so many years. Because he's they were in the American League. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Because for me, he doesn't get why I like the Brewers. And I'm like, well, because, why do you hate the Brewers? I'm like, but for him, that was a rival. But for me, it's like, well, they were in the, to me, it doesn't matter. Because, in my lifetime, they've always been in the National League. So I guess that's a situation. I can't think of an actual, team moving to a spot and that being the rival. But I know from, divisions or conferences or whatever, you would have seen some of that. But, it's definitely an unprecedented sort of thing.
I'm too young to remember when the Brewers and White Sox were rivals. Like, I remember the Brewers being in the American League, but I think they were different divisions by that point. So it was nothing I'd ever thought about. As far as them being rivals. That's interesting. So Wilt was traded midseason to the 76ers right after the All-Star break, I believe. He had been dealing with a pancreatitis that had slowed him a bit during that season. The Warriors had really fallen off early in the year after Wilt missed a good portion of the beginning of the season and wasn't playing, by his standards, was not playing that well. Also, some of the doctors in San Francisco thought that he was dealing with a heart condition. His doctors in Philly disagreed, basically just saying, okay, he's just different from everybody else. You have to get him to really exercise before you can get, a normal-looking echocardiogram from him. Anyway, obviously, he turned out his heart, he was fine. He died, in his 70s, so it wasn't like he, the heart condition didn't slow his basketball condition down. So, in this case, the Philly doctors appear to be right. And the There were issues between Wilt and Coach Dolph Schayes, who, of course, was a Nationals, former Nationals great. He'd been a critic of some of Wilt's perceived selfishness, his whining, and his bad free throw shooting, although some of those critiques, Schayes said, were intended to be tongue-in-cheek. So there's and then in this season, on December 26, 1964, the Celtics actually made history by starting an all-black lineup with Bill Russell, Satch Sanders, Casey Jones, Sam Jones, and Willie Nahls. Went unreported at the time, and apparently Auerbach claimed to be oblivious to significance, but it was, of course, the first time that five black players had started for an NBA team, and notable given the racial history of the NBA and of America in general. The Sixers this season were 40-40. They actually were only slightly above 500 after the Wilt trade, so it took a little bit for them to kind of gel. The Celtics were 62-18, which had set the NBA record. So this was right around the 64-65 was right around the peak, you know, for the sure. For the Celtics and from the blend of, you know, the veterans and the rookies. So the Sixers beat the Royals, who we talked about in a previous episode, 3-1 in the first round. The Celtics had a bye, given that they had won the division. This being their final season, they won the division. The key Celtics were Bill Russell, Sam Jones, Sanders, and Casey Havlicek-Hyneson, which is his final season. And Ramsey and Luskadoff and Clyde Lavallette all retired after the 64 season. So some new blood here. They added Willie Nahls, who was a longtime Knick. We talked about a little bit in previous shows. He also played in the game in the against Wilt in the game where Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points. Larry Siegfried also added to the team, and Mel Counts. Future Georgetown coach John Thompson came off the bench as well. So.
These teams, one of the most remarkable things I think about these Celtics teams is how many future head coaches are on these. It's insane. Like, especially, yes. Like, I mean, some of them may be, you know, less renowned than others, but still, like, a lot of head coaches, like, just everywhere. Yeah. Like, you trip over a head coach every time you look at the Celtics
team.
Yeah,
I mean, Casey Jones, mm-hmm. Satch Sanders, Hyneson, Russell, of course, and John Thompson, at least. I can't think of anybody else off the top of my head, but I'm Drew's at least a couple. Yeah, obviously a lot of those guys were coaches, and many of them had big success. And Auerbach, he finally got his Coach of the Year award this year, although the Coach of the Year award, it was only like a couple, like 3 or 4 years old at this point. So it wasn't like it's not like he had been not given into it at all during his dynasty.
Well, it's good to know it's always been a terrible award.
Yes.
It usually goes to guys that coach like teams that were bad and now they're okay. So now you're the Coach of the Year. So there
you
go.
Well, hey, at least he didn't get fired after winning the Coach of the Year, happens, you know, occasionally. So the Celtics dedicated their season to Walter Brown, who was the famous owner of the team, one of the founders of the NBA, who died in September of 64. So the key 76ers were Hal Greer, Dave Gamby, Larry Costello, Al Bianchi, and Red Kerr. They all dated back to the Nationals, the Celtics rivalry of the late 50s, early 60s that we talked about in a previous episode. In fact, Red Kerr dated back to the 55 title team, and he was near the end of his career. Of course, he would move on to coach the Chicago Bulls and become a famous broadcaster and personality. Chet Walker had joined the franchise in 63, which was its last year in Syracuse. As far as newcomers, of course, Wilt, as we mentioned, he was acquired in 65 for Connie Durking, Paul Newman, Lee Schaefer, and cash. And that was not a very good trade. But again,
knew that at the time, right? Like, everybody
I mean, they knew it wasn't good. I mean, San Francisco was kind of in a bad position because that move had not gone well from a financial perspective. The fan base hadn't really been there, and they were performing badly. They had Nate Thurmond, who could kind of fill that role. So, you know, why do you have, well, they feel like maybe he's damaged goods with the with the health issues. Also, Wilt's his business manager was also the owner of the 76ers, which was kind of an interesting situation. So he kind of even said, like, don't trade for me. I might not even, you know, I might be done after the season. And they, you know, they were pretty confident they could convince him to stay. And obviously they did and had a lot of success. Luke Jackson was a rookie all-star at power forward. And there was a little bit of resentment from Hal Greer and Chet Walker, who were kind of the stars of the team at this point, over having to suddenly be overshadowed by Will. But they got through it well.
Yeah, hopefully.
Jeez. Yes. And Dolph Schayes was in his second year as a head coach for the team, as we mentioned. So how did the series go?
Series, yeah, a pretty tight series. Five of the games were within 6 points or less, with only one real blowout. So that's an interesting aspect of that. The home team actually won every single game of this series as well, which is another little interesting tidbit there. The 76ers won game four in overtime, 134-131. Wilt had 34 points, Walker 31, Hal Greer 27, and Sam Jones led the Celtics with 26. There's an SI article called My Life in a Bush League, and it was written by Wilt, and it featured criticisms of just about everybody in the NBA, especially his coach, and that comes out right after Game 4, and his quote here is, Shays is so tenderhearted that someone sitting on the bench can look over at him with those big wet eyes, and he'll put them in the game. So,
yeah, it was kind of just a, like, basically,
wait for the offseason. Maybe right. Tell SI to push it back a few weeks.
Till. Well, that was apparently what he had said, like, oh, they told me it was going to come out during the offseason.
Yeah.
So, it came out before he expected it to.
I guess it's not too bad. And, he's a kid, passionate coach. I'm okay
with
that.
I mean, basically just kind of ripped, like, everything about dealing with fans and management expectations, hints at retirement, basically created a big fear among the league and his team. He actually was fined, I think the biggest fine in NBA history at the time, for the article, which was obviously a dumb way to handle it, but. I mean, it was kind of a combination of a lot of things that, oh, these are actually probably pretty good points, pretty logical. And there were a few things that were just like off the wall, kind of like, you know, what he's talking about type stuff. I mean, but obviously, you know, a player, even if Wolf Tetcher criticizing his team and the league during that time is not going to get.
It's not a very healthy league. Still not very. Having your stars say my league sucks is kind of.
Yeah,
not great,
right. But. Exactly. So and it's like, yeah, I care about the league, but these are things that are kind of getting in the way of it. Being so. So it definitely wasn't the best timing, whether it really had anything to do with them losing the series or not is, of course, up for conjecture. But is part of the story of the series.
Yep, and of course they did lose it. Game 7. I know you're going to be shocked here, but Bill Russell defeated Wilt Chamberlain in a Game 7.
Yes.
As a member of the Boston Celtics. I know it's pretty hard to believe, but 110-109. Russell had 15 points, 29 rebounds, 8 assists. Wilt had 30 points and 23 rebounds. 110-109, Russell inbounded the ball, only to have it bounce off a wire just above the court. And I believe we've talked about this play in a previous episode.
Yes.
And there's a video of it as well, which is pretty interesting because you don't get a whole lot of video these days, but there is one of this actually happening. And, of course, the rules at the time stipulated that this was a violation. Then the ball would be awarded to the opposition, the Philadelphia 76ers, of course. So they have the ball then down one. Pretty good situation. During the ensuing timeout to gather themselves, Russell pleaded with his teammates to get him out of this out of this mess. Otherwise, he'd be the scapegoat for the season ending in disaster. And as we know, Russell, as always, you know, for a guy who had so much success, he was also very, like, so nervous about lose. Like, he hated to lose, like, in any situation. It was, like, actually legitimately, like, you know, it drove him nuts in many cases. Like, so this would probably not be very good, but he didn't have to worry because when play resumed, with 5 seconds left, Hal Greer inbounded the ball towards Chet Walker. And then you might have heard of it or not, but Jan Havlicek, he intercepted the pass and batted away. And I believe somebody might have said Havlicek stole the ball, and you might have heard that before. So
maybe. It's possible.
It's really – they don't play it too much up in the NBA. I mean, you don't really hear too much about it. But, you got to that. But I was always interested to see because, of course, you see that part. But then I looked at a video, and they actually have a part of him bouncing it off the wire, which is really great. And it's just like the video just shows like 10 people pointing at the wire. Like, no, that's – because you see Russell throw it, and then the ball just doesn't – like falls. And then like everybody looks and like, wait a minute. Like, he hit the wire, which is just like, man, to be Russell there. But – you don't have to worry. John Havlicek saved him. So,
yes. So moving on, 1966, the Celtics won the series 4-1. During the season, December of 65, actually, part owner of the 76ers, Ike Richmond, who was a close friend and a lawyer for Wilt, he died during a game in Boston. He actually collapsed and slumped over the shoulders of Al Bianchi, one of the players for the Sixers. Dolph Schayes shouted for a doctor, and Auerbach and the Celtics trainer helped carry Richmond from behind the bench while team doctor tended to him. Eventually, he was taken by ambulance and declared dead at 52. His wife was called by the 76ers trainer who said to tell the team to win the game for Ike. They were distraught, but ended up rallying and winning and broke a 19-game losing streak in Boston, which is just kind of a crazy story for not only for him to die during the game and then for the wife to, you know, find out about it and then to, you know, like rally the team. It's just like an almost unbelievable sports story. But apparently it happened. It was documented in the rivalry in other sources as well. So that's a pretty amazing thing to happen.
Certainly.
Yeah. Also, Auerbach, as the series is getting closer, about to happen, Auerbach was asked if Russell had lost his edge, and he said, "I don't want to comment on that," and then also said that, you know, Wilt at this point, of course, had ambition to beat Russell, but Russell had nothing to prove. And his quote was, "But if it happens, and if it happens this year, remember that didn't happen until Russell was over 30. So it's sort of interesting to see Auerbach, the way he sort of feels about it, the way he's defending Russell, the way he's sort of realizing that, okay, at some point this could happen, but, you know, it didn't happen until, and, you know, it, well, of course it wouldn't happen for another year. But the fact that he was such, you know, really trying to address that openly, I thought was really interesting. That was from King of the Court. So the records here were 55-25 for the Sixers, 54-26 for the Celtics. So this was the first year the Sixers had a better record. The Celtics beat the Royals 3-2 in the first round, which we talked about in our previous episode. The Sixers had a bye, and the first time the Celtics did not win the division in the Russell era. They actually would not win the division again for the rest of Russell's career. This was also the last NBA playoffs where the division winner got a first round bye. They would add as they started to expand. They would have 10 teams in the league, and 8 of them would make the playoffs for a while until expansion grew further. But this was, of course, most of the same crew as you might expect. Heinsohn had retired for the Celtics, but everyone else was still there. Red Auerbach's final year of coaching. They did pick up Don Nelson, who became a key player for the Celtics in the late 60s and really into the mid 70s. He was part of the 70s championship teams as well. So
another coach.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Pretty famous coach. Might have the most wins ever.
I'll check on that. I don't think so.
For the Sixers, we have Wilt, Greer and Walker, Jackson, Bianchi and Gamby return. Kerr's finally retired, and Costello actually spent this year in the Eastern League before he would return to the team in 67. Billy Cunningham's a rookie on this team and very important player for them. And then guard Wally Jones is added to the team after a year in Baltimore, and Shays returns for his final year as a coach. So Rich, how did the series go?
Yeah, as far as the series overall, Sam Jones led the Celtics. He had 25.8 points per game. Havlicek had 25.4. Russell had 14, so you start to see a little bit of the Russell. Again, 14 points isn't bad, but you're starting to see him slowing down a little bit. Wilt had 28 points per game in the series. Auerbach focused his strategy on going after the rookie Cunningham with presses, figuring, it, you know, rightfully so, that his inexperience would cost the 76ers, and Cunningham averages 5.3 points per game, down from his 14.3 average that he had during the year. So Red Auerbach, chalk one up for him. It's decent coach. Decent idea there.
Smart.
Good idea, Red Auerbach. One of your few. But so Boston won games 1 and 2 handedly. 76ers came back and they won game 3, 111-105. Boston, they won game 4 at home, 114-108. Game 5 in Philly, 120-112, and that clinched the series, of course, for the Celtics. Game 5, Havlicek had 32, Sam Jones had 30. Russell chipped in 18, so not bad. Wilt had 46 points, but unfortunately, as he was wont to do, he was only 8 of 25 from the free throw line. So, did it cost them? They probably weren't going to win the series either way, but yeah, that would have made up a pretty decent difference. But that was it, unfortunately, for the 1966 76ers. So.
Yes. So then we move on to 1967, which was in the Eastern Division Finals. Sixers finally get a win. They win the series 4-1. Wilt finally beats Russell. We talked about some of this aspects of this before, but getting into a few more details about it. The big difference was that the Sixers added Alex Hannum as their new coach, had replacing Dolph Shays. And Hannum had coached Wilt in San Francisco, led them to the finals, so he knew how to handle Wilt. He also famously won the led the St. Louis Hawks in 58 to the championship, so had two championships during the only two championships non-Celtics winning during the Russell era. From the rivalry, Russell particularly thought that this 76ers team was unlike any of other Wilt's teams because they had four players who could score consistently in addition to Wilt, Cunningham, Greer, and Walker. And the Sixers called one aspect of their game "milk it," which meant everyone on the team fed the ball to a player with a hot hand. And there's a story regarding that of Wilt having 29 field goals in a row over two games, closing in on the record of 32 in a row, which I believe he already was his record. And then Alex Hennem took out Wilt during the game, not realizing he was so close to the record. The players encouraged him to put Wilt back in, which he did, and that angered Gene Shue, the Baltimore coach at the time, to because it was near the end of the game, of course, and the Sixers had it handily, but I believe he did end up breaking that record, and I think his record is 35 or something close to that, but good record. At first, the Sixers when Wilt had joined the team, they would have been divided more into racial cliques, but now they were more integrated. Particularly, Billy Cunningham and Wilt were very close, and they would hang out a lot together off the court, which is unlike the Celtics. At this point, the Celtics were more, they were older guys, and I think older guys are more likely, of course, to, spend more time with their families and less time, hanging out. As you get older, most people get less interested in going out drinking and hanging out. Whereas the Sixers were generally a younger team and, had more players that had more camaraderie with each other. So not that necessarily makes a huge difference when it comes to, your effectiveness on the court, but it was just sort of interesting, right? The different approaches for the different players. So, the Celtics were 60-21 this year. So still obviously a very strong record. Philly set the record with 68 wins, 13 losses. The Celtics had beaten the Knicks 3-1 in the first round. The Sixers had beaten the Royals 3-1. As we mentioned, this was the first year where every team had to play in the first round, no matter whether there were no byes anymore. Russell, of course, has debuted as coach. We talked a little bit about before. He did have some difficulty adjusting to just the strategy of being a coach, would do things like playing Sam Jones accidentally for 48 minutes or, just substitution things, just things that, are difficult to manage when you're also worrying about playing in the game. He obviously would get better at that and would win two championships as a coach, but there were some stretches where, it was difficult and caused frustration with his teammates and especially with the fans. We have Russell, of course, Havlicek, Casey and Sam Jones are still here. Sanders, Siegfried and Don Nelson, Bailey Howe and Wayne Embry are two, the veterans, who were added to the team. We'll be part of the championships for the next couple seasons. For the 76ers, we have the crew that we talked about before. Costello returned for a year in the Eastern League. And the new players are Matt Gukas, who would later be a 76ers and Magic coach in the 80s and 90s, and then future Nets star Bill Melchione, who we had talked about. I think I talked about actually with Adam in a previous episode I forget what the episode was now, but anyway, we talked about him before. Bill Melchione, he was didn't play much for the Sixers here, but would later become an important part of the Nets in the 70s. So Rich, how did the series go?
Yeah, first off, overall, Hal Greer, 29.2 points per game. Wilt had 21.6 and Walker 20.6, so decent outputs from all those guys. Yep. Celtics were, they were led by Havlicek. He had 30 points per game. Jones had 21.1, and Russell now, as we mentioned, you slowly but surely seen it, he was down to 11.4 this year. Wilt had an impressive game one. 24 points, 14 rebounds,
Yeah,
14 assists. Sorry, that's where I got it. Yeah, so 24, 14 assists and 32 rebounds. That made sense. I was going to say 32 assists. That's pretty good. Scott Skiles.
Yeah, that would be a record, yes.
Yeah, jerk. Well, Russell, well, Chamberlain's got you beat. But, so apparently he had an unofficial quadruple double, but of course wasn't taken at that time.
Yeah, blocks were not.
I'm sorry, but should have been. That would have been sweet. It would have been nice to see a guy like Russell. See what he would have done. Yeah, game two, it was broadcast on ABC, but the broadcaster's strike forced it to be filmed with a single camera in black and white with a producer giving play-by-play, which is not an ideal way. But hey, they were on TV, so that's a start. I mean, it's better than where they were before, so hey.
Sure.
We'll deal with it. Also in game two, the Celtics rallied from a 14-point deficit with a small lineup of Casey Jones, Siegfried, Havlicek, Jim Barnett, and Bill Russell. But Philly ended up winning 107-102. The press, of course, ripped Bill Russell for this, for his coaching job, and the fans booed him. So not a good start for Russell, which is great. It's like, you know, like we always talk about, you know, they'd won like a lot in a row. It's just like, I love that they're like, come on, like,
pretty incredible.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Let's go. Like, we have won, so what, six at this point? What, six in a row at this point? Or,
eight in a row
at this point. It's just like, geez, okay, well, tough crowd, but it's all right. Game three, the Philly fans were chanting Boston is dead because they won 115-104. Russell had 10, 29, and 9. Wilt had 20, 41, and 9, which is not bad output. This set an NBA playoff record, of course, for rebounds with 41. Celtics barely hung on to win game 4, won 121-117. Russell struggled with leg cramps, but hit the clinching free throws to win the game. And then we get to game 5. Boston outscores the Celtics. Philadelphia outscores the Celtics 97-57 in the final 30 minutes for a 140-116 win. The scene was described at Philly's Convention Hall as a cross between a Roman arena and a garbage dump. Fans smoked cigars to mock red, threw rags, potatoes, and coins on the court. So they were quite happy to finally break that streak. So they did so by throwing eggs at people, which is just that's hard to clean up. I mean, at a basketball game, come on. Yes. Popcorn. Popcorn's easy. You can clean up popcorn easily. Who had eggs? Who brought eggs? Why were there eggs?
Don't bring. Like, yeah, I mean,
who brought potatoes? Eggs. Like, how are you allowed to bring this stuff into an arena?
Yeah, they obviously did. The security was not was a little more lax.
Why? What purpose of that? Like, if they didn't win, what were you going to do with the eggs?
Throw them at your team, I guess. I don't know.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. Okay, all right. Yeah. Makes sense. But anyway, that's.
Yeah. So the Sixers celebrated with champagne, which of course they had not won the championship. They'd only won the division, but and very ecstatically. Will sort of thought he was very low key in the celebration. There's descriptions in both the rivalry and King of the Court where, you know, he kind of felt that the Celtics' domination of him was largely bad luck. And we've gone through all the close calls that if it had gone just a slightly different way in a couple of those situations, Wilt would obviously, you know, have had four or five championships and Russell still would have had a lot, but not quite as many. And it would have been a more balanced than we kind of think of it historically. And he kind of felt like his teammates had bought into the myth, you know, believing they had toppled the dynasty when really they had just beaten an aging team in the second round of the playoffs. In King of the Court, it was described as he had retained his cool aloofness in victory. He had already insisted he was the greatest player ever, so he found no validation in beating the Celtics. And a writer named Jeremy Larner wrote that he had nothing to do but to assert and simply reassert his simple, sterile pride in his own existence. So it was kind of like a difficult thing for Wilt because, you know, he essentially, because he's supposed to do this, because he's supposed to be great, and because he believed in his greatness, even though he had lost so many times to the Celtics, it sort of made the victory not that exciting for him. You know, and it also I didn't write it down, but I remember there also being a description of where like Wilt basically was like, oh, now they're gonna expect me to do it again. It was kind of like, you know, he couldn't find the true joy in this because of just the burden of expectations that that he dealt with, which, you know, a lot of things in his life being just the size that he was and never being able to kind of like live a normal existence. It's obviously, you know, a tragedy when you're so famous and you know, such a striking figure that a difficult thing to do. And
I've always felt, and not to get off, but I've always felt a lot of LeBron James and Wilt, where it's just like, you know, like he's sort of destined to always be great, and then like no matter what you do, like because LeBron almost seemingly never takes joy in victory, because like, and rightfully so. I mean, there's always like, you know, oh well, you know, Jordan did it this many times, or this guy did it this many times, and oh, you know,
yeah.
And anytime he fails, it's like even in winning, it's like, oh, you won two in a row. Well, Jordan won three in a row. You know what I mean? Like it's always just been that, and I've always had that idea of those two because it just seems. Like, and it seems to bother LeBron as well as it bothered Wilt too, where Wilt, you know, should have just saw joy in this and said, ah, screw, I don't care what people think about me. I'm great. Yeah. I'm really good. And I'm, you know, I'm a talented guy. I'm living a great life. But it was always just sort of worried what the narrative or what the perceptions were going to be of him. And
he may have enjoyed, I mean, he might have found the joy inside. Obviously, we're not in his head, but it was interesting to see kind of the, Yeah, and I agree about you with LeBron. I mean, you know, he might celebrate in the moment, but there's always like it's always like, oh, this isn't good enough because you have to deal with these expectations. And you know, and with Will, it's like almost like if he celebrates, then he validates what everyone has said about him. And in this moment, you know, this moment is great because it overcomes all the validation things. It's like he can't celebrate too much because otherwise it like you know, all the critics that have been criticizing him are right if he does that, which, you know, puts him kind of in a no-win situation, you know. But
I'm glad nobody cares. I'm glad I have no expectations in my life.
Yes, great. Yeah.
Anything I do is a positive. So.
Right. That, there you go.
According to my mom.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Hey, you know, I think your mom's right, you know. I think you're cool too, Rich. Not
thank
just
you. Thank you, Jay. So,
anyway, Russell and the Celtics congratulated the victors in the locker room, and then at a banquet later, the Celtics kind of had an annual dinner every year after they would, you know, before they would go on break. And Russell had kind words and silly jokes during that. So there was not really a lot of sadness or forlorn. I mean, they'd won 8 in a row; they were due. Everyone kind of felt like, I'm sure. However, while leaving the court, he did seek out Casey Jones, who this was his final game, and then he was going on to be a college coach for a while, and then of course would later be a coach for the Celtics in the 80s. And then of course the Sixers would go on to beat the Warriors in the NBA Finals, and it was which was the second of three titles in franchise history. Anything else about 67?
No, that's it.
All right, so moving on to 68, the Celtics get revenge. They win the series 4-3.
Much needed revenge. Finally, the Celtics get their due.
Finally, yes. The Celtics were 54-28 during the season. The Sixers were 62-20. Still, obviously, very great. The Celtics had beaten the Pistons in the first round. The Sixers had beaten the Knicks in the first round, both 4-2. Casey Jones had retired, but basically, other than that, the Celtics brought the band together. The Sixers had Wilt and Greer, Walker, Jackson, Wally Jones, Billy Cunningham, Gukas, and Melchione were all back. Gamby was gone, however. They did add a veteran, Johnny Green, who I think we talked about before in the Wilt 100 podcast, was the first NBA player to actually play through age 39. Now, he got kind of a late start, but he still had an incredible longevity throughout his career and was a decent contributor on this team. So how did the series go, Rich?
Yeah, so a little bit of highlights first. John Havlicek, he averaged 25.6 points per game. Jones, who, you know, he's at 34 now, starting to slow down a little bit, but for slow down for him, at 23.6 points per game. And Russell recovers a little bit, 13.7 points per game, so he does a little bit better than he did the prior year. Hale Greer, 26.1 points per game, Wilt with 22, and Walker with 20.3, so we're starting to see a little bit of slip from Wilt, but of course, you know, slip for Wilt is still pretty damn good. And of course, he'd be okay. Wilt would be fine. But so the Sixers were, of course, here without Billy Cunningham. Bunch of other. I mean, this is, of course, you're thinking 1968. You kind of do the math here. You go, oh no, this might have come. Yep, MLK was actually assassinated on April 4th, 1968. Of course, and this affected Game One. The Celtics and Sixers each had to deal with the decision of whether or not they would play the game. This, I believe, we talked about this in our Wilt episode, correct? So there was that.
There's no reason that we don't need to go through all that again. Sure. But the important thing, I think, is that, you know, the Celtics handled it in a way where they were very open. They had like a very open discussion and were able to kind of hash it out as a team, whereas the Sixers didn't really. Like, Alex Hannum later lamented, basically, like, you know, I should have called a meeting and let everyone, you know, talk it out and, you know, say whether they would want to play the game or not, because, you know, they finally had like a team meeting right on the basically at the deadline, you know, like 40 minutes left to before they played the game. And, you know, it just led everyone to kind of get upset and even made it even more difficult to made the situation even more difficult and just kind of poison the well a little bit, I guess, to a certain extent. Although they ended up losing game one, but they were able to win games 2, 3, and 4. So they actually had a 3-1 lead in this series.
Yeah, and this is the first time a team was down 3-1 and won a series. We'll get to the final game here because that's, I think, the most important one. a little bit. Yeah, so of course, this is Celtics won 100-96. This was, of course, that game seven of the Eastern Division Finals. Russell had 12 points, 26 rebounds, 5 assists, and 10 blocks. The Celtics jumped out to an early lead and were able to stay just ahead of Philly for the duration of the game. On the final minutes, the Sixers were only down two. Chet Walker, he has a shot, and it's rebounded by Russell, who's fouled. Russell misses the first free throw. Sam Jones approached Russell and said, "Bend your knees, Bill," which helped because he made it. And then Russell then would block a Chet Walker shot and get a rebound off of a Greer miss to seal the game. And, of course, this is, in a way, I guess, somewhat famous for Wilt. Did not do a whole lot. He was injured and only took two shots in the second half. Russell was credited for outplaying Wilt and outcoaching Hanum after his coaching and playing had been questioned the year prior, of course. We talked about that a little bit before. So this was it. They beat, went on to the NBA Finals, and they would go and beat the Lakers to win the NBA Championship. Finally, bringing a title back to Boston after a year.
Yeah. So. there were a couple notes I wanted to bring about earlier in the series that I thought were interesting. Like in game three, Hal Greer had 21 points in the fourth quarter to lead the 76ers to a win, 122-114. That was kind of a rally there. In game four, Russell assigned himself to defend Luke Jackson instead of Wilt so that he could help on Hal Greer. But then Jackson wasn't much of an offensive player. But Jackson was able to kind of score on three straight outside shots to give the Sixers the win. And later kind of you realize that was a strategic mistake. After game four, Russell said he didn't really want to give a pep talk because the Celtics didn't really like believe in that. It's like, hey, you guys are adults. You can get motivated yourselves. But he sort of made a joke to Don Nelson about – he's like, hey, you guys don't want to go home. He's like, Don, you don't want to go home to Moline, Illinois, right?
No, he doesn't.
And everyone kind of laughed and just kind of, made the situation that was tense, everyone cut the tension a little bit. In game five, the Celtics defense ended up shutting Philly in the fourth quarter, allowing only 2 of 20 shots during a stretch, and Boston won by 18. And then game six, a really strategic change. Basically, Russell was setting picks on the high post, which drew Wilt out on the perimeter where he didn't like to go. And Wilt only made 5 of 21 free throws and drew 5 fouls, which led to Russell then attacking the basket and Wilt not being able to foul. So Boston ended up winning that game 114-106, of course, leads to the game that you described, game seven. So, there were some interesting things within the series that we wanted to talk about too. But so after this point, Wilt ends up getting traded during the offseason. He just he was kind of unhappy. The ownership had ended up changing after the owner had passed away, and Ike Richmond he had passed away, and they had, and now it was sort of an ownership that he was not that into. He had sort of been reluctant to go back to Philly. He wasn't really happy there and wanted to go out to LA. And the chemistry there, Wilt and Hanum had some, they didn't necessarily not get along, but they there had been some conflict, some heads butted there. So it was kind of time for Wilt to go, and he ended up being traded to the Lakers. And unlike the first trade, Sixers actually got an okay return. I mean, it definitely wasn't equal, but Daryl Imhoff was a pretty good defensive big man, and Archie Clark was, a pretty good scoring guard. So they actually did have, this season they actually finished 55-27, and the Celtics only finished 48-34. So they had a stronger regular season record, but again, the Celtics managed to win this playoff series 4-1. The Celtics, their only big addition was guard M. Bryant, who came over and was a pretty good defensive guard. And then they also had Don Chaney on the bench, who didn't really play much for this season, but would be a key player on the 70s teams. Meanwhile, the Sixers, now clearly led by Cunningham as well as Greer and Chet Walker. Greer at this point was getting into his 30s. Walker was still a fairly young player. Wally Jones, Luke Jackson, Kukoc and Green all returning for the team. So how did the series go?
Russell, he coasted through the last weeks of the season, but he turned it on for one last postseason, which is probably not a bad idea. Bill. Yeah. That's a good idea. The Tim Duncan method of, yeah, you know what, I'll just chill and see what
or
happens.
Or the LeBron method at this point, too.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, what's going on this year. Yeah, but so the Celtics, they were led by Havlicek. He had 27.2 points per game. Howell had 19.4, and Casey Jones had 17. Bill Russell only had 6.6, but as we mentioned, he sort of coasted through what it appeared to coast through much of the season to turn it on in the playoffs, which we'll see here in a little bit. The 76ers, they were led by Cunningham, who had 24.4 points per game. Clark, he had 19.4. Imhoff, 19.2. And Greer started to slow down a little bit on his own end with 16 points on the season. Yeah. Game one, Russell had 2 points, but he made it up for it with 15 rebounds, 8 assists, and 12 blocks. And Boston won by 14. Boston won game 2 in a blowout at home. Then they won game 3, 125 to 118. The Sixers came back in game 4, won 119, 116. So it was all up to game 5, which Boston won 93 to 90. And Bryant yelled, "Philly is dead," but Havlicek tells him to cool it, and they have bigger fish to fry. So that's an interesting thing. And then the Celtics, they again beat the Lakers in the finals in 7 games. And that was the end of Russell's career, of course, and yet another championship for the Boston Celtics.
Yes, and we talked about that coming at Wilt's expense once again. So, all right, anything else, Rich?
That's it.
All right.
You got one. Hey, you got one. So
yeah, hey, it was a big one, too. 68 wins, nothing to sneeze at, you know. So, yeah, and we talked about, you know, the fact that the Sixers probably, if they had been able to kind of hold them together and, you know, been able to make it work, could have obviously, I mean, they really had the chance to be one, you know, those most of their key players were still young enough to contribute to the over the next 4 or 5 years. I mean, everyone, they ended up basically trading everyone away in the next couple of seasons. But, you know, Chet Walker, you know, was a strong player for the Bulls. Cunningham was an MVP in the ABA. So they still, you know, the key guys who were contributing for those teams were still, you know, very good players for another, you know, 4 or 5 years. So if they had been able to kind of hold all that together, Will obviously being with the great, you know, Lakers teams. So you definitely could have seen them emerge as a dynasty over the next few seasons. But of course, they end up being the worst team in NBA history by 73 before bouncing back in the Dr. J years.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely.
Thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at Over and Back NBA both on Twitter and Facebook, and you can also, we would greatly appreciate it if you would leave us a rating review. We're on iTunes and Stitcher, so if you just do that real quick and give us some props, we would greatly appreciate it. Helps other people find us, and it satisfies our egos, which is the most important thing, obviously.
Absolutely.
So, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.